Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and an enthusiastic welcome to our new listeners from Southern California, from station KPBS in San Diego. The city of Paris is a fortress today. Millions of protesters vote with their feet in support of free speech. The global hunt for a possible accomplice in the shootings in Paris last week may have been foiled by the suspect slipping into Syria. And Charlie Hebdo plans to run controversial cartoon images of Muhammad in its first issue since the fatal attacks on their offices. An estimated unprecedented press run of 1 million copies. Today we look at the transformed security situation in France as thousands of troops and police are deployed to guard public places, including synagogues. We also look at the people who are doing a much better job in slandering Islam than any obscure French satirists. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram in Nigeria share media tactics. We'll talk about that. And in the case of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they may have found common foot soldiers in the Paris shooters. The Obama administration did not send a high-level representative to the rallies in Paris over the weekend. Instead, the administration focuses this week on internet privacy, with two proposals today that may open the door to easier government surveillance of consumers. How the president reconciles the contradictions of surveillance and privacy is expected to be one of the important reasons to watch this year's State of the Union address. But our focus at the top of the hour is on the Paris attacks and what we are learning about what terrorist organizations Saeed and Sharif Kouachi and their associate Amedy Coulibi may have been acting for last week. For more on the suspects, we turn to Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Michael, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So we should note at the top, all three of these suspects are dead. They were killed in the end of the shooting in Paris. But what are we learning?
Well, as you said, the three suspects are dead, but the fourth suspect may be in Syria, which is sort of the most head-scratching thing about all this. Since the conflict there began last year, the year before, and ISIS really took hold, our fear has been about people leaving that area and coming to the West and launching attacks. Well, that may have been the case here. Now it looks like it's been a safe haven. The travel is so easy in Europe that someone could do something in France, fly to Turkey, and easily slip into the border of Syria and have a safe haven there on the other side of an attack. And that is just something that in this whole thing I had never thought of. The whole thing is that they're going to get trained there and come to the West, and now we're seeing the opposite.
Now, in this particular case, you're referring to the whereabouts of Ms. Boumediene, who is believed to be the common-law wife of one of the late suspects and who made it back into Syria before the attacks began. What do security officials say about the reason for this? Is it Turkey's laxity at the border?
Well, they have a very, very long border, similar like we have a very, very long border with Mexico, and it's very difficult to protect that. And at first, it didn't appear like the Turks were incredibly serious about protecting the border, but they've gotten better in the past few months as the U.S. has put pressure on them. But it is a very difficult border to protect. And if you're in Europe, you can fly to Turkey as if you were in New York, and you could fly to another city in the United States. The travel there is much easier. So you could easily get on a flight from France and fly to Turkey and then get off and then easily pass over the border. And there, no one's really going to be there to stop you. And this has been the problem from the beginning.
Part of the eerie aftermath for those of us who are not as dialed into the security apparatus as you are, Michael Schmidt, is the hearing the voices of the terrorists themselves in a radio interview that was put on the New York Times website and was available publicly. And also, here is the voice of Amedy Coulibi, who's declaring his allegiance to ISIS in this video. We'll listen to him in French, and I'll translate for you.
Vous attaquez la Khilafa, vous attaquez l'État islamique, on vous attaque. Vous ne pouvez pas attaquer et ne rien avoir en retour.
You can hear in there, referring to the caliphate, to the Islamic State, you attack the caliphate, you attack the Islamic State, we are attacking you now, one can't attack and get nothing in return. Coulibi here declaring his allegiance to ISIS, while the Kouachi brothers seem to be declaring their allegiance with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. What does that say?
It's one of the more remarkable things here is that you see sort of two different threats, two different groups working together in the same instance. We had never really seen that before, certainly in recent times, where Al-Qaeda's affiliate from the Arabian Peninsula, which is widely regarded probably as the biggest threat to the mainland U.S., then ISIS, teaming up with ISIS, which the U.S. is now bombing there, and which with its European partners. And so what we're seeing here is a coordination of groups in a way that we hadn't seen before. And how did that actually happen? It certainly doesn't appear like it's a coincidence. But what is the connection there? We know that some folks from AQAP had gone to Syria to work with jihadis there on bomb making and to train them. But the idea of a thought of a coordinated attack between the two, that was something that we certainly hadn't thought of.
You know, I have to ask you, there are certainly lots of questions being asked about the French security establishment in the aftermath of the Paris attacks. But U.S. officials were the source of a lot of information that was coming out last week. Have you asked your sources if they can answer this question? If we knew here in the United States about the Kouachi brothers, the same level of detail that American officials seem to have known or French officials could have known, would U.S. officials have picked them up or restricted their movements so they couldn't have, like, wandered into a New York Times office and started shooting?
Well, the first explanation we received from American officials on this was that the French had said that there were other things that they were concerned about. There were other threats that they had to put their surveillance resources on, and that's the reason why they weren't following the brothers at the time, or certainly not in the past recent months or even years. So would the U.S. have looked at this differently? I don't know. The United States doesn't have infinite resources to do surveillance. I think the number of people that the government could surveil 24 hours a day would probably be a lot lower than we think it'd be. I don't think it would be in the thousands. I mean, it may not even be in the hundreds. So is that a fault of the French that they said, hey, we think we have threats elsewhere and we need to put our resources elsewhere? Well, certainly, in hindsight, it's clear what they should have done. But I don't know. The United States drops surveillance on people all the time because they don't think that they're a threat or they don't have the legal authority to continue to monitor them. So it's a much more complex question than simply, oh, this was a stupid mistake.
Well, thanks for raising it. Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Meanwhile, the monsters of Boko Haram continue to slander and malign Islam in the pursuit of their own bizarre insurgency in northern Nigeria. The latest tactics of this group, brags about kidnapping women and selling them as wives, has forced young girls to be suicide bombers in at least two open-air markets, while amassing a death toll of victims in their shooting rampage across the northeast of perhaps 2,000. Joining us is Alexis Okewo, freelance journalist based in Lagos. Alexis, so what's going on? Can you chronicle what we've seen over the past week or so?
Yeah, since last Saturday, there was an attack in a small fishing town in northeast Nigeria. It was not the first time this town had been attacked, but the effect was devastating. Hundreds of people were killed, hundreds of homes and buildings burned, and most of the town tried to flee on foot or by boat or however they could. Boko Haram then occupied the town. And it began over the next couple of days to attack surrounding villages and towns, up to 16. And it's believed that perhaps up to 2,000 people may have been killed. And even if it wasn't 2,000, at least hundreds of people were killed. And that area remains a no-go zone.
Some of the reports suggest that individuals from the village, and I believe it's Baga that you're talking about, were caught in the crossfire as the government's attempt to roll back Boko Haram has been as vicious as anything that we've seen so far.
Yes, in Baga, residents were caught in the crossfire, much like they were in 2013 when Boko Haram attacked Baga in a devastating way. After Boko Haram left the town, the Nigerian military came in and led a crackdown that killed almost 200 people. So the residents of Baga have either been under threat from Boko Haram or from the Nigerian military.
Does Boko Haram want to hold territory in northern Nigeria, or is this a consequence of a chaotic situation?
Well, when Boko Haram first started, it expressed no interest in holding territory or occupying towns. But its thinking has evolved recently. It appears that they're trying to copy the Islamic State, which now has a huge territory in Iraq and Syria. And Boko Haram has also seized a territory that will soon be equal in size, perhaps, if the Nigerian military cannot stop them. What they do now is they attack towns and villages, and they leave a few members there, and they stay there, and they prevent residents from moving around freely and going about their lives as they used to. And this is definitely a new tactic that they're doing pretty successfully. They've occupied much of the Northeast.
How would you describe this report that young girls were enlisted to be suicide bombers?
This wasn't the first time we had heard about young girls being used as suicide bombers. That was late last year when a young girl, about 13 years old, told reporters in Kano, a city in northern Nigeria, that her father had enlisted her to be a suicide bomber for Boko Haram. She said her father was a Boko Haram member, but that she refused. And at that time, a few other child bombers had been used by Boko Haram. So it seems that this is something that they're doing now, along with using female bombers. Over the weekend, there was a young woman bomber on Saturday, and then two more on Sunday in another northeastern state. So it just seems Boko Haram is getting more brutal and vicious.
Alexis, no one would say that Boko Haram is actually working with Al-Qaeda or ISIS, but it seems that their imitation of the terrorists in the Middle East gives them a profile that they wouldn't otherwise have, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, because it's interesting. When Boko Haram began, they began out of very specific conditions against corruption in the Nigerian government, poverty, lack of education, and they were a very local group without any ties to terrorist groups around the world. And what they wanted was an Islamic state, or they wanted Nigeria to be ruled with a more Islamic leanings. But now, as time has progressed, no one knows what they want anymore beyond the fact that they take enjoyment in killing and creating havoc. And part of that is imitating these terrorist groups that they see online or through TV of what they're doing, this increased brutality. And so it is disturbing because it's clear that what Boko Haram is doing is not aligned with any particular vision or goal or objective. It's just to be as brutal as possible. And one of those ways is to copy the Islamic State, the gruesome things that they're doing in the Middle East.
Alexis Okewo is a freelance journalist based in Lagos. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Maybe there is no way to reconcile privacy with the growth of the internet and the many forces interested in monitoring, stealing, or disrupting its flow of information. The Obama administration wants to create some regulations to at least alert consumers of the potentially unavoidable dangers in the era of Sony's leaks and Edward Snowden's revelations. The Personal Data Notification and Protection Act would impose a 30-day time frame for companies to notify consumers if their data has been hacked. And a companion act, the Student Data Privacy Act, would prevent nosy advanced technology from enabling companies to make money off of valuable data collected from digital devices in schools and universities. Is this solid armor for users, or kind of an admission by the government that they can't really ensure anybody's privacy anymore? Nuala O'Connor is president and chief executive officer of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a nonprofit organization focused on advancing a free and open internet. Nuala, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think? Admission of defeat?
No, I think this is a good step forward. I will give the Obama administration a solid, maybe a B minus, since we're talking about student privacy today. As a mom, I'm delighted. It's the right thing to do, but companies should have been doing these right things all along with our kids' data. But as a U.S. citizen, these proposals fall far short of what we really need, and that's protection against ubiquitous government surveillance. So why I give them a B or maybe even a lower grade is that the real issue today facing internet users, facing anyone living in the digital age, is the sense of their data, their information, their communications being sacrosanct. And I am far more concerned about the transmission of data to the government and the potential abuse and misuse by government actors who can, let's be honest, put you in jail, which is far more serious than sending you an ad. And the blurring of the line between data collected by corporations and data collected by the government. So while these are good proposals, and I think they could even be stronger, but they are certainly a good first step, they are really tinkering around the fringes of the big issue today in digital life, which is how safe are we, how truly secure are we in our communications, in our email, in our privacy of our online experience.
Do you think that these acts, though, do represent a shift away from ironclad firewall protection versus notification and disclosure as really the strategy moving forward for consumers online?
Well, I certainly hope not. And I would caution any company against thinking that these are going to be adequate protections that supplant good cybersecurity, good structured data holdings. And a layered defense, a layered security system is really what's called for that involves not just good policies and procedures by companies, but really secure systems. And what we've talked about in the past is, you know, the Sony hack, the Target breach, the Home Depot breach. If companies, big and small today, operating any part of their business online do not realize that cybersecurity and data privacy are top-tier risk issues for their companies, they are living under a rock. These are the number one, two, and three issues for risk committees, for CEOs of any type, not just tech companies, but anyone whose company touches the internet in any way.
But under this rock is also the indication that governments are going to take extraordinary steps to monitor people such as the terrorist individuals who are involved in the Charlie Hebdo case. And, we're learning more and more just how much information was available. Take out terrorist and insert consumer, and it's the same technology, right?
I think what happened in Paris and what has happened over and over again in Boston, in New York, is tragedy on an unbelievable scale and horrific. And we already had the tools in place to monitor people, and we still were not able to prevent those attacks. So, you know, having worked at Homeland Security with the inimitable Tom Ridge, you know, he would tell you that more data is not necessarily better data. More data is just more data. And what we need is a combination of physical intelligence, of personal intelligence, of data intelligence. So I'm not saying that no data should be in the hands of the government, but I'm saying that very limited, very, very secure and very targeted collection is what's necessary, not ubiquitous bulk data collection on your grandmother's telephones and your email to your sister about, you know, your kid's birthday party. So I think there's a role to be played for technology in national security and law enforcement. But your point is also well taken. The ability to collect incredible amounts of detailed information. And as we moved inside the home with the smart home, with the smart car, with smart appliances, the level of granularity, the level of detail that your devices can reveal about you and your personal habits is mind-blowing. I mean, it's exciting also from a utility standpoint. If I could tell my refrigerator to, you know, go tell the local grocery store that I'm out of milk and have that milk on my doorstep when I get home, I mean, that improves my quality of life as a working parent. There are great advances in healthcare and energy and environment and in education that can be afforded to us by better data, by better technology. That is true. But if we're going to use all these great technologies, we've also got to have good rules in place. And so we do support the idea of both self-regulation and regulation and legislation to improve the structure, to improve the protections for the individual.
Well, we will see how much the president wants to elaborate on these proposals in his State of the Union address later this month. And we'll also see if there's any bipartisanship as far as going forward on this strategy here. But you made a reference to something that I want to end on, and that is, the question of having someone send you an ad versus the question of the government putting you in jail are radically different. And I would totally agree with you. But I'm wondering if, given the proliferation of information out there from your devices and everything else, if lawyers are going to have to go back and look at this distinction between government access to information and commercial access to information to make more of a clear line between the two, because I think it's becoming pretty blurred.
I think you're right. The blurring of the lines is the big warning signal we should all be taking in this digital age. But we have historically had a difference between our relationship to the government and our relationship to the private sector in privacy in the United States. The Privacy Act of 1974 only covers government. And that's why these acts, let's put that in the larger context, these are good step forwards to realize the data is flowing everywhere all the time, and we need a sense of structure and a sense of order in our commercial data as well as our government data.
But if Verizon decides, when the government asks, to hand over their commercial data, what's the 1974 Act going to do to protect us?
Not enough right now, that's for sure. You're 100% right.
Newell O'Connor is president and chief executive officer of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a nonprofit organization focused on advancing a free and open internet. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. You weren't dreaming last week when you heard this promise of a free college education from the president.
If a state with Republican leadership is doing this, and a city with Democratic leadership is doing this, then how about we all do it?
That's President Obama speaking at Pellissippi State Community College in Knoxville, Tennessee on Friday. That state has had a tuition-free community college program since 2008. It gives students a chance for free college without having to do something like enlist in the U.S. military. In Tennessee, they must simply maintain a 2.5 grade point average. Chrissy DeAlejandro is the executive director of TN Achieves, an affiliate program of Tennessee Promise. She joins us from her office in Knoxville. Chrissy, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So this Tennessee Promise idea has attracted, I was looking at the numbers, a huge number of high school graduates. What would you say it is at this point?
It's been incredible. 58,000 students across the state applied this year for free community or technical college. So it's been an exciting few months here in Tennessee.
This is a total backstop for Tennessee students who may have aspirations for other colleges, but at least know that they'll be able to get in to some form of community college education, at least to start.
Absolutely. We definitely know that Tennessee Promise also serves as a plan B, if you will, for students who want to pursue that four-year bachelor's degree. We just want them going somewhere, but really the target would be that first-generation low-income student that never thought that college was a possibility. We're hoping to bring them into the pipeline.
Now, does the effect of this program, which you've had since 2008, turn community colleges into four-year institutions, or have the traditional non-community college four-year institutions modified their affiliation with community colleges to allow more of a transfer from one to the other?
That's a great question. I think what you're seeing in Tennessee is a great amount of alignment, which could not be any better for students. So Tennessee's really stepped up in terms of the four-year schools, looking at the two-year colleges to say, what can we do to better serve students? And so I think everyone's committed to this pipeline, and not simply to ensure more students are entering, but more students are earning either an associate's or ultimately a bachelor's degree.
So we're not talking about high school remediation here. A school like Vanderbilt, one of the top schools in the United States, is looking at these students.
Exactly. Because what they understand, I talked just last week to a student with a 31 on the ACT, whose mom said, you're not going to college. We simply can't afford it. But 31 is going to start at a community college, spend those 2 years, and then transfer to potentially a Vanderbilt. Why not?
And how much has this cost the state? Has it developed a popularity, a bipartisan popularity that insulates it from budgetary considerations?
It's a last dollar scholarship. So what we do is allow all state and federal aid to come in first, and then Tennessee Promise would fund what the family or student would otherwise owe in tuition and mandatory fees. So it averages to about $1,000 per student.
Now, I know you're probably going to say yes to this, but is there any evidence that this program will scale nationally before we go?
I'm hoping. You know, the president's plan is quite different from what we're doing here in Tennessee. We're looking at it more holistically, understanding that mentors matter, for example, and having a support structure. So I'm hoping that states will step up and that we will see something where opportunity for all is something we see across the nation.
Well, stay tuned for the details in the president's State of the Union address later this month. Chrissy D'Alejandro, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
Chrissy D'Alejandro is executive director of TN Achieves, part of the Tennessee Tuition-Free Community College statewide program. When computers can beat humans at a strategy game like chess, we sigh and admit that computers can do some things better than the brain. But in games of chance, humans still believe that their gut instincts about a jack of spades or a pair of deuces aren't any worse than some computer algorithm. Until now, anyway. Researchers in Alberta, Canada, made a computer program that pretty much has mastered the simplest version of Texas Hold'em. It's not like in Vegas. This version features only two players and restricts the number of raises, but it's a disturbing trend. Joining me now to explain is Michael Bowling, professor in the Department of Computing Science at the University of Alberta. Professor, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on the program.
What have you discovered here in the nature of your algorithm that allows you to have an advantage over humans in a game of chance?
So what's really new, and our interests are in artificial intelligence. How do we have computers be able to make decisions in areas we normally expect that we need humans to? And while we've known that we've been able to have computers perform very well at games of perfect information, as you've mentioned, like chess and checkers, where all the information is available that you need to make a decision. What's special about poker and special about many decisions that we make on an everyday basis is that you don't have all the information. You're missing the key bit, which is the other player's cards. And so building algorithms that can cope with that, that's what's exciting.
And does it involve you having a huge archive of scenarios that successful poker players have used? Or are you playing the numbers in some way? How do you do this?
So it's not enough to just sort of look at what your odds of having good cards are and knowing what cards are going to come up, or at least the probability that cards come up. I mean, good poker players have all the odds down as well, too. And it's not enough to look at sort of past poker hands. What we actually do is we don't really trust how the humans have played in the past anyway. So what we actually do is have our program play billions and billions, actually trillions of hands of poker against itself in a sort of training phase. So before it sits down at the table, it's actually sat down at its own table and played for 2 months of poker against itself.
Sat down. Sure. Yeah, right. Professor Bowling. But how does a computer, I don't care how many games it's played, know when to bluff and know when to actually play the cards?
So that comes down to actually just having played the game. And so in its trillions and trillions of games against itself, some of those times it will have bluffed when it's playing against itself, and itself on the other side of the cards has fallen subject to that bluff and folded its hand. And so it's determined that, hey, bluffing actually works sometimes. And then it's narrowed down the probabilities and with which hands it bluffs with based on what's worked against itself in the past.
Does it on some level have to kind of roll the dice when it bluffs, that after all the information is assessed, you're really sort of, deciding on the one hand, on the other hand?
Yeah, as you mentioned, poker is also a game of chance, and so we haven't taken that element out of the game. Our program plays what's called a mixed strategy, which means that it actually is probabilistic. It sometimes will bluff when it has bad cards. It will sometimes just fold them. It'll slow play with some probability its good cards, and it's doing this also to protect itself against what the other players can learn about it and take advantage of. And so when we say we have a nearly perfect program, what we mean is that it can't lose to anyone in the long run. And the long run, is on the order of hundreds of thousands of hands, ideally. The more we play, the more high probability that it's going to be a winning player. And that's all we can guarantee. On any given hand, it might get dealt the worst cards, and the right thing to do is to fold them.
Can you use this algorithm online on gambling sites to make a million?
We don't use our program online to play for money. Part of this is just to make sure that the interest and attention is focused on the science. It's also against the terms of service on the online poker sites. So people who are doing it are at least doing it on the down low.
I noticed you didn't mention whether you could or not. Sounds like maybe you could, Professor Bowling.
there is a small number of heads-up limit games, the game exactly game we play. It used to be quite popular in the 2000s. In the last 5 years, humans have actually gotten very strong at the game, to the point where the difference between the top players and sort of the next rung of players is so small that it's very hard to get a large enough edge on them to overcome the rake of the casino. So it's not as profitable to play this game among human players. My guess is the computer would still have enough edge that it would be profitable if there would be anyone to take them up on it.
But again, it's against the rules, and we should advise against that. Michael Bowling, professor in the Department of Computing Science at the University of Alberta, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Some more thoughts now on individuality and collective consciousness on a day when society is thinking about solidarity and outrage over the events in Europe. We are increasingly aware that our online thoughts and data are not our own. As our society grows in density and numbers, we can see the decisions of individuals as more a product of some collective outlook, whether it is the vicious programming of jihadists or simple marketing of soap. Who is in control of your destiny? Kara Miller, host of the show Innovation Hub, produced by our partner WGBH in Boston, says the science of human decision-making is becoming an exciting focus of researchers. Great to talk to you again, Kara.
Great to talk to you, John.
So let's talk a little bit about decisions and the science of decision-making. Are people really viewing this as psychology, neurobiology?
I think it's all of those things related, but I think one of the most interesting findings to come out of a lot of the recent research in labs across the country, even overseas, I talked to people at McGill, is that you really have a separation between what we intend to do and how decisions are actually made. And some of the really interesting research comes from the lab of Nicholas Christakis at Yale, and he's found that many things that we think are a matter of our own willpower, right? Like our body size or how much we're going to exercise or whether we vote or whatever. They're actually catchable. So they're kind of like the flu. Here's Christakis talking about what he and his colleagues have discovered.
We have been able to show using both observational and experimental methods that seemingly very personal things like your emotional state or your body size or how kind you are or whether you vote or not depends on whether other people around you do that, and even other people you don't know. So if your friends' friends' friends are kind, or your friends' friends vote, this can ripple through the network and affect you.
Now, there's a little chicken and egg problem in here. Is he convinced that you're actually catching something from your friends as opposed to just sort of hanging out with kind people?
Yes. So, I mean, he has studied these networks a lot. And actually, what first got him started was this very common effect, the widowhood effect, where very often a spouse will die not too long after the first spouse dies. Or that's been well known for a long time. And he is a medical doctor, and he was noticing that it was happening. But then he was noticing that it wasn't just spouses. It was friends of spouses and friends of spouses, people who didn't even know the spouse who was deceased, that ended up becoming sick as a result of somebody that they didn't know becoming sick and passing away. What he's finding is something very much beyond, all the cool kids are smoking kind of thing, mm-hmm. right? This is networks of people that are beyond people you've ever met influencing you.
Of course, marketers will tell you that it is important to be cool, right?
Yes, exactly. And you know what's interesting, too, is that marketers are picking up on this. So you have companies now, very new companies, that are actually looking through Instagram photos and trying to figure out some of these networks, some of these emotions, and actually scanning for whether people are happy in a photo, and then trying to figure out how they and their network then should be marketed to. So you already have marketers picking up on that. And I talked to Jennifer Lerner at Harvard, who has looked not just at how other people undermine our decisions, but also how our own brain undermines our decisions. So in one of her experiments, basically all she did was show people a clip from a sad movie or have them write about something sad, and she saw that their decisions completely changed.
We find that people will sell their possessions for significantly less money when they're sad than they would in a neutral state, because they're eager to get rid of it, and they are willing to pay much more to buy various goods when they are in a sad state. We ask them, did your feelings as a result of watching that movie clip or writing what you wrote, did your feelings in any way affect your buying price? They say, what, are you kidding me? No, absolutely not, you know, because they think that would be irrational.
Now, that is fascinating. That is really, really fascinating. But it can't all be moods. Isn't there, you know, learning by example? Isn't there, you know, somebody does something that, you know, everyone sees and goes, oh, I want to be like them?
Oh, for sure. And, you know, you see that in ecosystems like I would submit to Hollywood, where people are much thinner than they are in the rest of the country. What happened there in some sense, and Nicholas Christakis from Yale will talk about this, is that somebody seeded that network with an idea that thinness is desirable. And somehow that idea sort of emanated out from the person who came up with it and completely shifted the perception of everybody in the network. And so you think like you're making a decision, you're making your own decision about how thin you want to be and you're in Hollywood. But in fact, subtly, there's all sorts of things that are undermining that decision, right? There's all sorts of other influences that you just are totally unconscious of.
We are largely products of our social networks. But even if that's the case, our work also shows that your actions affect others. When you make a positive change in your life, when you act kindly towards others, when you vote, when you express joy and happiness towards others, it doesn't just benefit you, it benefits those people and, in fact, ripples out and could affect many, many other people.
It's Nicholas Christakis of Yale. So to use the Hollywood example that you brought up, Harvey Weinstein is a renegade in Hollywood, so therefore he has to be a larger fellow than the thin folks you describe.
Well, now, every single person I talked to, all of whom were researching this idea of decision making and how, you know, our decisions are undermined in some way, every single person said, look, there are always outliers. There are always people who look at the way that a network is behaving and will be the one or two people who will say, you know what? No, everybody's acting in a mean way, but I'm going to be nice. Everybody's acting in a nice way, but I'm going to be mean. Right. There are always people who, in some ways, I talked about decision-making being a contagion a little bit, are immune to the contagion, just as, you know, people all over the place are immune to different sorts of contagions. I also asked people, I said to them, you know, this research scares me a little bit. Does this mean that if you know certain things about me, like who I associate with and, you know, my emotion and maybe my gender, that you can predict what I'm going to do? Jennifer Lerner said, pretty much.
Pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. And Nicholas Christakis said, I kind of can, but it also means that your power to affect other people is magnified, even if your power to affect yourself maybe is a little less than you thought.
Kara Miller, host of WGBH's Innovation Hub, which you can now hear on WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.